This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Today we had a breakfast speaker, United States Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, who represents the 17th District of Illinois. That includes the Quad Cities area, Peoria, and Rockford. Her district stretches all the way from parts of mid-central Illinois to the Iowa border and the Wisconsin border. Congressman Bustos is completing a fourth term as representative from that area. She is actually the first woman to be elected to the United States Congress from that district. The theme of her remarks were behind the scenes, a real look at the Democratic majority. Congressman Bustos' main responsibility, in addition to representing the over 700,000 people in her congressional district, is to be the lead recruiter of candidates for the Democratic Party. She said the party faces a difficult 1.5 years ahead of us. She is the second woman to run the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the first being Representative Nita Lowey, who's now head of the House Appropriations Committee. The first Illinoisan to run the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, by the way, was soon-to-be outgoing Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Congressman Bustos works very closely with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She was asked to describe Nancy, and she said she's a very practical woman. Her game is tennis. You lob to the other side, e.g. the Republicans, and then you go back to the center and deal with the center. She talked about the issues that the Democratic members of Congress, particularly the new ones, should face. The number one issue to her that she hears from her constituents, the cost of health care. Number two, rebuilding the infrastructure. And number three, cracking down on corruption in Washington. Under her leadership and Speaker Pelosi, 18 freshman Democratic chairs now head subcommittees. Her job, she said, is to protect the front line. 31 Democrats currently serve in districts that voted for President Trump. She said the House majority of 17 votes is a very fragile majority. There will be 33 battleground districts for control of the House of Representatives in 2020. And most of the information that she's receiving from her colleagues, and particularly people in her district, they don't really want to get into the details of the Mueller report. They're more concerned about the cost of health care, rebuilding the infrastructure, and returning government to the people. Congressman Bustos is well known for spending Saturday mornings in the supermarket aisles of her district and for a program called Cherry in Shifts. Sherry Bustos takes jobs for one day with people in factories, industries, and elsewhere to get a foot-on-the-ground approach to what is important to her constituents. Sherry Bustos, our guest for today.
Well, good morning, everybody. Jay, thank you so much. I am grateful to you. It's good to see so many friends here and some new folks who I am meeting for the first time. I hope that I'll have a chance to say hello to more folks as the morning goes on. But I'll try to be efficient also with this, so there's time for questions and answers. So I'm calling this a behind-the-scenes look at what we're doing in Washington, D.C., because I figured I don't know if I would be able to draw a whole lot of people if I didn't promise to have something a little behind the scenes. I saw that Mayor Pete's going to be here. My guess is that's going to be a standing room only crowd, and I'm actually pretty excited about him along with some other folks. So I was here a couple years ago standing at this same stage, and at that time I said we had a path to take back the majority, we meaning Democrats, I am a Democrat, that we had a path to win back the majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. I had a role where I was working on messaging, but I was also working on recruiting candidates and working very closely with candidates all over the Midwest, all over the heartland. And these were some of the toughest districts in the entire country. So I talked about that, and that was the pledge I made. I think we're going to be able to win back the majority. I also talked a little bit about my grandfather's hog farm. So we literally covered the whole gamut. My cousin Colleen Callahan is here, who actually grew up on a hog farm. So we did cover the... everything. She said everything is better with bacon. You are so right. And the bacon here is absolutely phenomenal. So hats off to the chef and the hogs. So what we ended up seeing, though, was really this historic change. And what I'd like to talk about a little bit more, while Democrats are now in the majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, we've got a difficult year and a half ahead of us. And I think what you see day in and day out in the media and what you think is going on in Washington, D.C. is a little bit different than what is actually going on in Washington, D.C. And that's what I'd like to talk with you a little bit about today. So I am the second woman. So it's kind of a drag me second, but I'm the second woman to run the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. The first, well, I don't know. Is that second counts? Okay. Kind of. I'm an athlete, and I like to be first. But the first chair was going back to 2002. It was Nita Lowey, currently the congresswoman who is leading the Appropriations Committee. That's how far back we had to go to have a woman. But Illinois has only had two chairs ever to run the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Did you know that? And does anybody know who the first was? Rahm Emanuel. All right, so one of the first things that I did after being elected by my colleagues for this position was I wanted to call all of the former chairs and really got some great advice. And Rahm was one of the first calls that I made. And I know you guys have a swearing jar. And so if I were to share what he shared with me, I would definitely have to contribute to that. But so let me talk a little bit about, though, some of the best advice that I got. And it was from this woman right here. I work very, very closely with her now as the chair of the political arm of House Democrats, and she is the speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. We travel a lot all around the country, but what she shared with me is something I think is very critical. And you think of Nancy Pelosi from San Francisco. You think about the literally tens of millions of dollars, if not more, that have been spent against her over many, many, many years. And, you know, she's been labeled as this San Francisco liberal. And what I can tell you, she's as practical as anybody I have ever worked with in any field I've ever worked with. And so her advice, and she says this, she will say this in a room full of all Democrats, and they might be the farthest left Democrats you would know. And she will say this: we've got to govern like you play tennis. And do we have any tennis players in the room? Not a whole lot, but and LaRue, well, or we can govern like LaRue. You were a center, right? LaRue, where'd LaRue go? You were a center, right? So Speaker Pelosi's advice is this: you govern like you're playing tennis, and that is when you get a ball returned to you, you hit one over, you always go back to the center so you're ready for what's coming next. So think about that. And that is coming from Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She is as practical as they come. So what I'd like to talk with you about today is a little bit about what is actually going on in Washington, and specifically focusing on the new members, because they are getting a lot of attention all over the country, and it is what I was very, very much involved with in the last cycle. So here are just some of the headlines that spotlight the real work that these freshman Democrats are doing. There's stories that really do get lost with the inside the Beltway drama all the time. And what they are doing is they are bringing to Washington, D.C. what they know at home. So I'm going to highlight just a few of the folks that you may not have heard about. You guys, anybody know who that is? Okay, it is not. She said Ocasio. No, it is not. This is Charisse Davids. She's from Kansas. She defeated a Republican to get to Congress. She is, and the reason I've got that picture on the left is she is an MMA combat fighter. I kid you not. She's also one of two of the first Native American women ever to be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. And she's phenomenal. Anybody know who that is? Crickets. So it is not, but I appreciate your guesses. I appreciate it. This is Abigail Spanberger. She's from Virginia, and she was a CIA operative, and she is amazing. also turned a red district to blue. And anybody know who this is? Okay, good. Oh, I kind of buried the lead on that one. Okay, so thank you for reading his T-shirt, but I should have like blurred that or something. It is Colin Allred, and he is from the state of Texas, a state that is changing literally by the day in its politics. And we picked up two seats. Democrats picked up two seats this last cycle. Colin was one of them. And he's also a former NFL player, played with the Tennessee Titans. Amazing. He's just had a brand new baby. And in Tennessee, we picked up another seat with a woman named Lizzie Fletcher. This cycle, we have six districts that are on our radar to try to play in. That's the changing demographics in a place like Texas. But the reason I show these folks is they are not on Saturday Night Live. They are not on the cover of the Rolling Stone. But they are the type of freshmen, and there are many freshmen just like them, who you should know their names. Because they are doing some amazing, amazing work. If you broaden this a little bit, we have the most diverse freshman class ever in the history of Congress. And they are reasonable, they are solutions-oriented, and they are as common sense of people I have ever seen. And literally, their service, while they're not in Washington, they are going home and they are doing these town halls, they are doing hospital visits. And while that is not necessarily sexy or glamorous and not getting the headlines, it is the real work that members of Congress do. And this is exactly, in my role last cycle, this is what I envisioned that we needed to make sure Congress had going into the 2020 cycle. I was one of the three co-chairs of what was called is called the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee. And as part of that work, we ran on a platform that I just want to go over with you briefly. We ran on it, we won on it, and now we are governing on it. And so it is called the For the People Agenda. And it focuses on three things, pretty simple. We've got to address the cost of health care. We've got to address the cost of prescription drug prices. I hear it all the time. It's the number one thing I hear when I do what I call Supermarket Saturdays, just walking the aisles and asking people what's on their minds. It's the number one issue that I hear. Number two is we've got to rebuild America. It is what gave us our competitive advantage, and we are losing that competitive advantage. We've got to rebuild America, and we're talking about our roads and our bridges and our electrical grid. We're talking about schools, locks and dams, all of that. And then number three, we have to crack down on really a Washington, D.C. The word swamp is pretty accurate. I don't want to repeat something that, by the way, Nancy Pelosi first started in 2006. She used to talk about draining the swamp. We've got to do this. We have to address the corruption, the secret money, the dark money that that is playing too big of an influence in politics. So these were the three things that we ran on. They are kitchen table issues. And I'm going to introduce you to three freshmen now who where you'll see how we have brought this home. I know you recognize Lauren Underwood. so proud of Lauren Underwood. And for those of you who followed her race, you know that she had a pre-existing condition. She had a problem with her heart, and she understood that it was the Affordable Care Act that helped her make sure that she had coverage. And she knew that with this attempt to take away health care coverage, that was impacting people all over the country, and she wanted to do something about it. So Lauren goes from running on that issue to leading that issue. She literally is one of the leaders, already as a freshman, in introducing legislation that addresses these junk insurance plans. These are the ones that you may get them pretty cheap, but then when you go to use them, they're not going to be any good. All right, so she is a leader on that. She is also a leader on making sure that we do bring down the cost of prescription drugs. If anybody here has diabetes or has a child with diabetes or a grandchild with diabetes, you know that the price of insulin keeps going up and up and up and up. And now it can be as much as $2,500 for a month of insulin. That is not sustainable. So Lauren understands that, and she took that from the campaign trail all the way to Congress, and that is what she is focused on. Infrastructure. Do we have anybody interested in infrastructure in this room? All right. a lot more than who knew our freshman members of Congress. So, you know, it's critical. It is absolutely critical. And we here in Illinois can be ground zero because we're right in the center of the country where everything goes through. So that was the plank number two that we ran on that I told you about. So, as you know, President Trump introduced this trillion-dollar transportation package pretty early in his administration. But the problem with it is it was not workable. You can't all of a sudden change the funding formula and turn it on its head and expect local and state governments to come up with, and the private sector to come up with 80%, where the federal government's only going to pay 20. So we are now reaching across the aisle, and this woman, another freshman, is Abby Finkenauer. She's from the state of Iowa. She borders the congressional district that I serve, so I got to know her very well during the campaign. She would have been the youngest woman ever elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. But there's one person who is younger. I'm guessing most of you know who that person is. But Abby is, she's 30 years old. And again, ran on the fact that she wanted to make sure she was doing something to address infrastructure. So what'd she do? She's on not only the Transportation Infrastructure Committee as a freshman, but she is also the vice chair of the subcommittee on highways and transit. So for those of you interested in that, get to know Abby Finkenauer. She's a smart woman. She's got a great background. She's got a tremendous work ethic. And this, she's already a chair as a freshman of a subcommittee. By the way, one side note on that. One of the biggest Democratic classes ever was after the Watergate, in the Watergate era. Not one freshman held a gavel in a subcommittee, not one. This term right now, we have 18 freshmen who are chairs of subcommittees. Okay, pretty phenomenal. And again, the woman who had the sunglasses on earlier, Speaker Pelosi, she made sure that that happened. All right, so number three, we've got to address the money, the voting rights. Make sure that everybody feels like government is actually working for them, for the people, as opposed to for special interests. So literally on the day, I think it was the day before the tax bill was voted on and passed, there was a member of Congress who went out and bought a yacht the day before it was passed because he knew that this would impact the taxes that he had to pay. So that's the kind of stuff where there's no reason that the tax benefits really benefit so few. And so we passed what we call the For the People Act, which addresses the dark money, that everything has to be declared, that there has to be total transparency on all donations, that anybody running for president has to show their taxes. And it is really a matter of returning the power to the people. And so the third freshman I want to tell you about is Dean Phillips, and he's out of Minnesota. And this was what he ran on. By the way, he's got a great Chicago connection that I love. His grandmother was Dear Abby. Is that not awesome? Yeah. And really a phenomenal guy. But here's what he did. When I look at these campaigns that these guys ran, it was nothing that you would read in a textbook, I'm telling you. So here's what Dean Phillips did. He's in Minnesota, and he knew that people were telling him about how they just wanted Washington to work better. So what he did is, in the land of 10,000 lakes, he takes an old pontoon and calls it the government repair pontoon, and would literally go out to boaters on one of those 10,000 lakes and talk about what did they want to see work better in Washington. He did the same thing with an old milk truck and called it the government repair truck. And that was made the same year that there was a Democrat back in that district. It had been decades, literally decades since there had been. Obviously an old milk truck like that. So, and then we have any fishermen or fisherwomen in the? Okay, so you probably know what that thing on the bottom left is, right? It's a, what do you call it? An ice hut, ice house, fish shed. What? But anyway, he mounts that on a trailer and he drives that all over the place and has office hours in that so he can listen to people. So this is the kind of campaign that we saw all over the place. And now what is he doing to bring it back home? He is on right off the bat. Has begun doing town halls so he can continue to listen to people. So he's actually operating as a public servant should operate. So we've got a few other members across the country who are following this kind of campaign, this kind of public service, and I just want you to take a look real quickly at this.
Democrat Xochitl Torres-Small has finished ahead by a slim one-point margin.
Democrat Andy Kim has been declared the winner in New Jersey's House race.
It was a rematch from the 2016 race in Congressional District 2, and this time Democrat Angie Craig came up on top.
My district is enormous and incredibly diverse.
This is the district that I grew up in.
It's about 50% suburbs and exurbs.
If you're going from the southeast to the northwest, it can take up to 8 hours.
We have some of the best beaches.
About 50% rural.
Absolutely would need to put in a good music list because the radio doesn't work everywhere.
Certainly from my area, it's very much a Phillies Eagles area.
My district, no matter where people live, the theme is people just want an opportunity to earn a good life.
Healthcare.
The cost of prescription drugs.
A job that can pay a good wage.
Investment in infrastructure.
The cost of childcare.
Climate change.
Access to a quality education.
Issues where the rubber hits the road.
And the kitchen table issues that impact their lives.
We may disagree on 10 things, but we can all find something we agree on. And usually that's a love for New Mexico, a love for green chili, and a love for the outdoors.
They want an opportunity to work hard and to have a shot at this thing we call the American dream.
When we reached out to everyone, folks believed in that.
It's about making sure that we are showing that who I am in that town hall in the most conservative areas of my district is the same person that's down here in Washington fighting on their behalf.
Only two sessions for the last 40 years my seat has been represented by a Democrat. And I believe part of the reason I'm here is because I showed up everywhere. Because I listened to everyone.
It's a district that Trump won by 6 points. It's a tough district for Democrats. We've only had one Democrat in this seat for decades.
Many of these communities feel like we've forgotten them.
I'm thinking about what matters to the people that I serve.
When I was thinking about running here, people told me that this was unwinnable. But these are the exact types of districts that we need to win to be able to continue to build out.
So you don't have to protect the front line, but I do. That is my job as the chair of the political arm of House Democrats. And just for kind of a lay of the land on that, we now have 31 Democrats who serve in Trump districts. Those are three more of them. I happen to be one of them as well. And so I consider this, while we have a 17-vote majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, I consider that a very fragile majority. So my advice to whether it's the folks that you saw here today, whether it is people who are looking to run, and we've got 33 battleground districts all over the country that we hope to play in, it is you've got to be hyper-local. So I got a question earlier about the impeachment talk. My advice is always you got to stay local. And if you listen to people like Dean Phillips did in his ice house or on his pontoon boat or in his milk truck, you know that what people in districts like the one I represent, where 60% of the towns are 1,000 people or fewer and 85% of the towns are 5,000 people or fewer, I can tell you I never hear somebody bring up the Mueller report when I do Supermarket Saturdays or where I'm doing what we call Sherry on Shift and I job shadow folks. But I do hear them say, we want you to get the job done. That's number one. So if we want to be successful, this is the message over and over again. It is being hyper-local. Sean Casten is doing that, and he's bringing his expertise. Sean Casten, who obviously picked up a seat from the state of Illinois, He's doing that with his background in science and talking about climate change. So he's taking what he knows from home and what he has lived and bringing that to science, or bringing that to Congress. On the right, Chuy Garcia, also a freshman. He is bringing what he learned in his life on issues of importance to immigration and job creation, and he is bringing that to Congress as well. But it is in the cattle barns. These are, I've done 85 Sherion shifts since I've been elected. We just call it that. And obviously, we've got now a guy named Jared. He calls it Jared on the job. He's out of Maine. And so we've got freshmen who are taking this model. But this is me actually doing, on the bottom left, I'm changing a street lamp with the rural electric co-ops. I'm on a barge here on the bottom right. I'm a car repair woman in the top right. But I can tell you, when you are working shoulder to shoulder with people who do hard work every single day, they do not obsess about the same kind of things that are obsessed on in Washington, D.C. So it is the folks in our brand new freshman class, again, 40 flipped seats from the 2018 cycle. That's phenomenal. 60 plus brand new members who have now held more than 200 town halls throughout this country. So they're listening to people. And now it is a matter of taking what we learned out of 2018 and making sure that we do more town halls than we do tweets, and making sure that we are building this bench where we can continue the most diverse caucus in the history of our nation. I think that makes us stronger, and staying focused on what we know is important to people. So that's my story, and that's what's going on in Washington, D.C. that you don't always read about. So thank you very much. Do we have time for questions?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Congresswoman. We have a number of questions.
Do you read them?
I look at them to make sure that, you know, they're legitimate questions and not just, you know, submitted by
As a member of Congress, I'm used to everybody being really, really nice to me. So,
just. Well, this is the City Club. We have no official rules here.
Okay.
Okay, so we have a number of questions here, and you mentioned the cost of drugs is a real important issue in that, and this is from Bob Gallo, who's the state director of AARP in Illinois. Robert, where are you? Great. Just became a member of our president's club.
You got a primo seat back there.
Absolutely. He likes being in the upper deck. Okay, the Bob Uecker seats. Anyhow, here's his question. Pharma's lobbying spending has reached a 10-year high of $70 million. While businesses and people struggle with unaffordable prescription drugs, what are your plans to change that, such as the reimportation of drugs from Canada, allowing CMS to negotiate drug prices, etc.?
Okay, gotcha. So he did say pharma, not farmers, just so to clarify.
P-H-A-R-M-A.
Yeah, I know. When I first heard that, I thought, farmers? What's the connection there? We've got numerous pieces of legislation. And as I said in my slide earlier, Lauren Underwood is one of the leaders of that. But one is to be able to allow Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs. Out of the last Affordable Care Act, out of the legislation that has preceded me, that has not been allowed by law. We think that that's one way to bring down the costs. Also, cost transparency. We think that pharmaceutical companies ought to explain how they're coming up with their pricing. And if there is an increase, and we've got this in legislation that is spelled out by a certain percentage, that literally there has to be a complete explanation as to why there is a huge increase in whatever that cost is. As far as allowing prescription drugs in from other countries, I'm certainly open to that. I am not an expert on that, and I don't know what legislation there is on that at this point. But there are literally dozens of pieces of legislation that address the cost of prescription drugs. And one thing, there's probably two things, and I don't know if there's any infrastructure questions in there. And if there are, let me just proactively say, Speaker Pelosi would say the same thing. She's going to be at Jan Schakowsky's power lunch later this afternoon, but she would tell you the same thing. When she goes to the White House and sits down with the president, there are two areas where he will say that he is happy to work with her and to work with Democrats to make sure that we pass it, because he ran on it in 2016. We ran on it in 2018, and we've got to make sure we get this done. One is the price of prescription drugs, and the other is a robust infrastructure package. So I believe because the president is willing, because you've got bipartisan support on those issues, I do think that we'll be able to address both of those and get something done legislatively this cycle.
Okay, thank you. This is question along a different line. This is from retired General John Borling, sitting over here, who's with Service Over Self, by the way.
From my congressional district.
He's from your district. He came all the way in from Rock Island or wherever.
I like how he typed it up. Does he have like a typewriter over there?
Maybe he has a staff. Who knows? He's a general after all, you know. Yeah. The Congressional Commission on Public and Military Service is considering a one-year military service program to augment the all-volunteer force and encourage shared values and experiences. Any thoughts on this?
I love General Borling. You know what? You should stand up, General. Thank you. By the way, I'll give a little bio info. He was in Hotel Hanoi with John McCain as a prisoner of war, and wrote a book called Taps on the Wall, and talking about that experience. So this is a guy right here at the front of the room who has given so much for our country, and I feel very fortunate that he lives in Rockford, Illinois. So, General, to your question, I certainly believe in public service. I think your thought is to make it compulsory. Yes?
With exemptions.
So I think that that takes a lot deeper answer and a lot deeper evaluation. But I certainly believe in public service, and it just kind of depends on how we incentivize the public service. Whether it's through kids who go to college and we help with their reimbursing them on their student loan debt. I mean, there's a lot of different ways we can address this. And I know you have briefed me. Yeah, and I know, in that, as he said, that is part of it. But I think we should look for ways to incentivize public service. We certainly need that. I believe that it's through public service that you can change the world, however that looks. I'm very proud to serve in Congress, even though I'm in a profession that is very unpopular. I know that every day I walk into the office, we are in a position to help people. And the other behind-the-scenes things that members of Congress do is we work with individuals who, by the time they come to our office, have just had it. And it could be a veteran. It could be an immigration issue. It could be a senior on a Medicare or Social Security issue. But in the time I've been in office, we've closed 5,500 cases, and I consider that 5,500 people and families that we've been able to help. And those are the kind of things that get zero headlines, but it's something that it makes me very proud to be able to have great caseworkers in our office to be able to help like that. But so, General, thank you for that question.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for that answer. This is from Terry Weaver, who's with the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her question is, how can universities partner better with rural communities to meet their needs?
We need you. We need everybody to help partner on this issue. It has to be a local, state, federal, private sector, public sector, educators, DNR is part of the answer. Illinois Rural Development, which Colleen Callahan used to run, is part of the answer. But if we don't invest in our rural communities, it will be devastating for the state of Illinois. I mean, as you know, we are in Chicago right now. This is our economic centralized engine. But still to this day, ag is our biggest economic driver. And so we can't forget the folks in my part of the country. I already explained to you my congressional district. And while Jay, in his introduction, talked about the Quad Cities, Rockford, and Peoria, in between that are 11 other counties that are almost all rural. It's a 7,000-square-mile congressional district, 14 counties, borders Wisconsin, borders Iowa, and it's almost all rural other than those slightly bigger areas of the Quad Cities, Rockford, and Peoria. And rural broadband has to be one of the highest priorities. It has to be, because we will continue to be left behind if we don't get on board with that. It's what the rural electric co-ops did for our smaller towns back in the 40s. And we need that to be kind of the new electricity for these rural towns, or we will continue to be left behind. But to the universities, though, we need your help on this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have several questions. You mentioned infrastructure. Mm-hmm. City Club member Greg Hummel, where are you, Greg? Right there.
Also from my district.
Okay. Ray Drake with United Parcel Service. Ray, where are you? Okay. Barb Cornu, she's with the Active Transportation Alliance. And
back there.
Brian Umbright, where are you at, Brian? Right over there. Okay, good. They all ask questions about infrastructure. And, for example, they range from what are the keys to passage and enactment of a $2 trillion infrastructure bill before 2020? Mm-hmm. Typically, transportation and infrastructure funding has had bipartisan support. In most cases, the result is inaction. What will it take to make it happen? Do you think it can happen? Barb, with the Active Transportation Alliance, how can you advocate for the upcoming Illinois Capitol bill to improve highways and bridges and make streets safer for pedestrians and bicyclists? General questions with regard to infrastructure.
Okay. All right. Well, as I said, I believe this is one of the two areas that we can actually make some pretty good progress on. I do believe that. So as you read in the news, the Speaker, along with Chuck Schumer and then some other leadership in the House and the Senate, Democrats, went over to meet with the President. And, they went into this meeting thinking we were going to talk about a $1 trillion infrastructure package. And somehow, as the discussion went on, it ended up at $1.8 trillion. So, and as you read, what was the number that was reported out of that? $2 trillion. So, I was with the speaker later that night at an event, and I asked if she would share what happened over at the White House in this meeting. And apparently, they got it through talking. They got up to 1.8, and the president says, 1.8. Let's just make it two. So that is how this $2 trillion figure came about. So very, very deep thinking and planning on that one. But there is a Peter DeFazio who has come to Chicago. I think some people in this room were at that event we had a discussion on infrastructure. Peter DeFazio is the chair of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee in the House. And in the bill that he's behind, there are three funding sources that get to $1 trillion. So it is real. It is not something that is kind of this fake proposal that's out there. And here's what it involves. And you're probably going to have people in this room who are going to be on both sides of these formulas. One is it's called Penny for Progress, where it would increase the gas tax by as much as 1.5 cents per year. No more than 1.5 cents per year over the course of several years. And then that money would be bonded to obviously stretch that out over the next 10 years. Number two, it would allow airports to set the passenger facility charge at the rate that they need to make improvements at airports. Again, the airline industry is not overly excited about that, but airport leaders are. Right now it is capped at $4.50. And then the third is there's a harbor maintenance trust fund that the federal government has taken out of for the general fund use for many, many, many years. This bill would call for the money in that harbor maintenance trust fund to stay where it is. And that gets to $1 trillion. And so how we get to $2 trillion, obviously there would have to be some other funding sources. And I think the other part of that is keep in mind that infrastructure, and I know everybody in this room knows, is a lot more than roads and bridges. It is also locks and dams. It is also the power grid. It is also schools. It is also rural hospitals. It is all of those things. So actually, it is not just the Transportation Infrastructure Committee that will be voting on what we call infrastructure. It will come also out of the Energy and Commerce Committee when you're looking at things like rural broadband and those sort of things. It'll come out of the Labor Committee. So there will be many, many sources of probably three or four different committees where this will come out of. So that answer, that was the broadest. Right. Do I need to drill down any deeper on any of those before everybody nods off further?
No, I think that was really
okay.
Good. Really
okay.
Good.
Okay.
Because we have some other questions here.
Okay.
Some are even a little more political than some
really?
Of the questions. Oh,
good.
Yeah.
I like those.
Good. This is from Josh Schwartz. Josh, where are you? Right over there.
Hi, Josh.
He wants to know if we are facing a constitutional crisis with the White House failing to respect congressional oversight.
That's a nice light one.
Now we're in the meat of the batting order.
Yeah. I think we should be very concerned over the Attorney General of the United States of America not being a candid, why don't I word it that way, in his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then making a decision because legal counsel was going to be among those asking questions at the House Judiciary Committee, and the Attorney General making a decision not to appear. I think we should be very concerned about that. And when the statement is made that there's no precedence for attorneys doing the questioning, all we have to do is think back to the Kavanaugh hearings. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. And but I think we should also listen very closely to what Speaker Pelosi is saying about impeachment. I mean, think about what that does to the country. And I'm a former reporter. What I did for most of my career, I was a reporter, and I was an investigative reporter for a number of years. And I think you've got to be guided by the truth in everything you do. And I don't have a problem with any of the committees, the Oversight Committee, Judiciary, Foreign Affairs. What am I leaving out?
Intelligence.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's a big one. Thank you. with them seeking the truth. But the other thing to note is while all of this has been going on, do you read about the 20 hearings that we have had on health care? Do you read about the 25 hearings we have had on infrastructure? So the real work is being done while it is impeachment and the Mueller report that gets all of the attention. I guess what I would say is we always have to seek the truth, and that is very, very important that we, the redacted report, in my opinion, we need at least the Intelligence Committee, the Oversight Committee, at minimum, need to see that. And then members of the House and the Senate need to be able to go in the safe and secure room where nobody can hack it or spy on us, be able to read that. You know, we are not going to get to the truth, the ultimate truth, unless we know exactly what's going on. So, but I think there's grave concern right now with the Justice Department ignoring that the Congress wants to hear more about what is happening in this investigation.
Okay, thank you. This is from Marcus Morrow. Marcus, where are you? In the back. Not a City Club member. Marcus, give you the same opportunity that we give 2,500 other people. $50, cash, credit, check that won't bounce. Oh, he's got it up in the air. Great. Now we'll read
awesome.
Your question. You can become a member of the City Club.
Otherwise, you don't read it.
Hey, we have to have some discipline. Okay.
Way to go, Mark.
He's with the Alzheimer's Association.
Yeah.
And he wants to know basically what's happening in Washington with regard to Alzheimer's research in the fight to end Alzheimer's and related dementias?
Well, that would be through the National Institutes of Health. And actually, we last legislative session, we passed the 21st Century Cures Act that added more money to research. I can't tell you the exact numbers on Alzheimer's. What I can tell you is that my dad donated his brain for that. And he had, Colleen can verify, he had as sharp a mind as as you can imagine, until the day he died at the age of 80. I think he entered this study because of my mom, whose brain might not be quite as sharp. And so they went through this annual evaluation, and so they could, you know, test their cognitive abilities. And then he donated his brain to science after that. So I know that doesn't answer your question specifically, but I thought I'd share that little personal family story. But as far as specifics, I can certainly get back to you as what the numbers look like. I just don't know them off the top of my head. Thank you, Marcus, and thank you for joining the City Club.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Marcus. And by the way, you know, your father, he was a great St. Louis Brown fan.
Cardinals.
And the Cardinals. Yeah, but the Browns moved to Baltimore, and that may have been before your time, Congresswoman. So, and a Cardinal fan, and he's sorely missed.
That's really a good announcement in Chicago.
Well, we had a pretty good weekend, you know. We won all three games. We're back in first. Those Cardinals are going back to St. Louis up on the hill. Okay.
I do think the Cardinals just swept the Nats, though.
We don't care about the Nats here. Remember, all politics are local. You're in Chicago.
Well, that's why I said, why are you mentioning St. Louis?
Okay. This is an interesting question. I'm not going to mention who asked it because we've answered one of their questions. But as you select candidates, what are some of the criteria that you look at, particularly if, say, there is a challenger for a sitting congressperson?
Who would that be? I was the vice chair of recruitment several cycles ago, and then, as I told you earlier, I focused on these heartland states this last cycle. So I've been involved with recruiting candidates for most of the time that I've been in Congress. And I also have this program that we call Build the Bench. I do that out of my own campaign to train people. We do an all-day boot camp to train people to run for office at any level. And the reason I started that Build the Bench program is I recognize that it was way too hard to recruit candidates in some of these districts, especially really varying the diversity of our of how any elected office looks. And so if anybody's interested in running for office at some point, my political director, Haley, is over here. And this Build the Bench program costs you nothing because we pay for all of it. But it teaches you the fundamentals of how you run for office and how you win. And the things that you have to get right this day and age if you're running is you have to understand messaging. You have to understand that you've got to have resources to win. So how do you get those resources? You've got to understand grassroots organizing. And because we are living in 2019, you have to understand social media. And so those are the four fundamentals that we teach. So when I'm looking at recruiting candidates, I want to make sure that they understand those four things. And for anybody here ever run for Congress? When'd you run, General? So what year was that?
Ages ago.
A few ages ago. Well, you know, a modern day campaign in running for Congress is it's really pretty much a full-time gig. You've got to be, especially, again, I told you the demographics of my district. You've got to be all over. You've got to be talking to people constantly. You have to have the resources to run very, very expensive campaigns these days. So, you know, in the end, you have to have somebody with a great work ethic, somebody who's got a background that people can relate to. And you've got to look at the numbers of a district. I mean, it is much a science as it is an art. And for instance, if as a Democrat, I would not run in John Shimkus's district in Southern Illinois, because a Democrat's not going to win that. I mean, I don't care. You could be the best Democrat in the world, and you're not going to win that district. There was a district in far southern Illinois that Brendan Kelly ran in last cycle, and some of you may have met him because he came to Chicago a lot to raise money. But he was like a near-perfect candidate and couldn't win that. You know, a Catholic guy, a military background, church-going, a father, a prosecutor. like a perfect profile for that district and couldn't win it. So that's the science part of it. You got to look at the numbers, but the art part of it is, can you resonate with people? Can you talk with people? Are you comfortable with people? And then again, having people have to be able to get excited to get the grassroots going, and you got to have the resources. So you look at all of those things.
Okay. That sounds like a very exciting program that you're getting potential candidates involved in.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm just wondering because Sherry and I first met many years ago when you were in the Illinois Women in Leadership Program, and they always had me in as one of the male pinatas to do a session for you, and I've been poked and jabbed many times, and she's just fantastic. Okay, so I'm biased. In fact, you have a lot of fans here. Jerry Latherow, you're with Latherow and Degnan. Jerry, where are you? He's right there. He wants to know if you're considering running for president. And if not,
why not?
He wants to know why not.
Yeah, we need more people to run, don't we? the answer to that in a word is no. No, I am not considering running for president. I don't think we need anybody else to get into this race. But I am excited about some of the candidates. And I do know that whoever is at the top of the ticket on the Democratic side matters a lot on how well I can do my job protecting the people who are in Congress now in these very, very tough districts and making any kind of gains. And if we end up nominating people who, folks in my part of the state in districts like this cannot relate to, I don't think things are going to go very well in the job that I'm in right now. I just think it's absolutely critical that we've got the right nominee. I won't tell you who I think is the right nominee, but I do think that we've got several people who are good. And however you want to look at this, because I'm thinking about who's from the Midwest, who's running, and I think we just have, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg? Is that it from the Midwest? I don't want the Midwest to be overlooked, I can tell you that. So whoever the nominee is, it's more than just Iowa and winning that first in the nation caucus. It is not forgetting the kind of people who I just talked to you about. I have a town called Hamlet, Illinois, in my congressional district. The population is 48. And I made this decision, I'm like, I want to go door-to-door there just to see. There are 16 homes in Hamlet. And it was so interesting. I'm walking down this little side street. I can't remember if it was a Saturday or Sunday. It was a weekend. It's hotter than heck. And all of a sudden, there's this woman driving her John Deere Ryder tractor down the middle of the road and yelling at me. And for whatever reason, she was yelling at me. So I go over there, and she wants to know, her house is just down the road a bit. She wanted to know if I would stop by and have a glass of Guinness with her and her husband and her son. They're hog farmers. And they loved John McCain. And John McCain had just passed right before this. And they wanted to toast John McCain. And, these are people who are, I mean, think about that. They're hog farmers. She's out on this weekend on this hot day on her John Deere. And I'm just, this person walking down the street and she wants to toast John McCain. But I want to make sure that who's ever running has those interactions with people and not just on a phony level. Because I see there's plenty of phony level politicians. And but you got to get to know people and their struggles. And that's why I do those Supermarket Saturdays and have since I was first elected. That's why I do my Sherry on Shifts and stand shoulder to shoulder with people. And was that our last question?
I have one final question after that.
Okay, but I want to share one story. Of just my last Sherry on Shift I did was just a week ago. And I rode on a van with this paratransit driver, which is, driving the van that helped people in wheelchairs and people with disabilities get to various appointments. So I'm talking to this driver in Galesburg, Illinois, and she makes $9 an hour. She has not gotten a raise in, she couldn't remember how long. She thought maybe 10 years or so. And she, when I always ask what people do for fun because it gets to their discretionary income. And so I asked what she did for fun, and she said, oh, I watch my neighbor kids play. Not a vacation in God knows how long, not a raise in a decade or so. Couldn't remember if she'd ever taken a vacation, and that's what she does. And those are the kind of people that I represent. And so whoever our nominee is, I want to make sure that they understand that. And every person who runs for Congress who I'm involved with recruiting, I want to make sure that they go out and they hear those kind of stories and they understand the people that they're representing. Because it's not all lucky people like us sitting in this room. Because we are lucky people. And a lot of people aren't as lucky as we are. And we can't, as people who represent them, we can't forget that. So thank you.
Okay, one quick. Okay. Thank you. One quick question, then we'll have our drawing. In the UIS story about you and the pragmatic idealist, it mentioned that not so many years ago, because you're young, you babysat for Loretta and Dick Durbin and their children. So the question is, did he pay you or did he take advantage of the relationship he had with your dad?
No, he paid very, very well.
I hope.
And all of his kids are angels.
They are. Okay.
Thank you.
Let's give Congressman Bustos a big round of applause. Yeah.